You ready to talk about the paranormal? Well, I am. Paul Eno back with us, and we'll jump right into it. By the way, his latest book is called Dancing Past the Graveyard. That'll tell you a lot right there. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul Eno, celebrating 50-plus years in paranormal research. Paul was one of the first investigators of the early 1970s. And beginning while he was studying for the priesthood, his early mentors included parapsychology pioneer Dr. Louisa Rhine, Father John Nicola, who happened to be a technical advisor for the film called The Exorcist, and legendary first-generation ghost hunters Ed and Lorraine Warren, the late. Paul graduated from two seminaries. He was expelled from graduate-level theology programs at a third. Why? Because of his work in the paranormal world, with less than 2 years to go before ordination, too. He ended up as an award-winning New England journalist and author or co-author of a number of books on the paranormal and two on history. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Paul, how are you, my friend?
Oh, never a dull moment, George.
No, it isn't. When was the first time we had your son Ben on with us? He was just a kid then, wasn't he?
He was. It was 09, I believe. And he was, he was still in high school, as a matter of fact. And he's been on, I don't think he's made it through an entire show yet, mainly because of his school and work schedules, but he loves it.
Well, he's a good guy. And you guys have been featured on the Travel Channel Shock Doc series and stuff. And he loves the paranormal. He picked it up from you, didn't he?
Well, I'm afraid so. He was 13 years old, and my wife and I had a long discussion about whether we should get him involved in this. And but he sat through hundreds of my lectures, sold books in the back of the room, and absorbed all my goofy ideas. So, but when he did come in, it was like he had, you know, sort of operating on a different level, very experiential. Whereas I try at least like to think that my feet are on the ground and it's kind of a more scholarly approach. But so he makes a really good partner for me, and we call ourselves partners in the paranormal. We've done the radio show going on 13 years now, and I'd have him by my side in any emergency, any time. And right from the beginning, he was terrific.
Well, that's fantastic. You've been doing this for 50-plus years. What keeps you going, Paul?
Well, first of all, time flies when you're having fun.
That's right.
There are all sorts of concepts, George, that I encountered from childhood and a religious upbringing, and then in the seminary. And the initial one, and I'm sure I've mentioned this on the air before, was, where is my father? At the age of seven, mm-hmm. I was witness, and you can imagine this is was difficult to talk about, it still is, I was witness to his suicide. And, you know, wonderful, wonderful man. He was Protestant. My mother was Catholic. My brother and I were brought up in the Catholic religion, Catholic schools. And the nuns at the time taught that if you ate a hot dog on Friday or didn't go to Mass on Sunday or committed suicide, it was straight to hell with you.
That's right.
So I said, my father, wonderful man. He was home with me because of his health at times when that was very unusual. My mother had to go out to work. And Sister Mary Joel, my second-grade teacher, kind of got me through all this. And I asked her about this, and she said, well, you know, God is kind of bigger than all that. That got me through, because the Sisters of Mercy were, you know, God bless them, some of them anyway, they were either, you know, saints or potential axe murderers, I thought. And
rulers, right?
She was a saint, got me through it. So that has always been in the back of my mind, you know. Where is my father? What is purgatory all about? What are these things about that we would mention casually in the course of a religious education, but nobody ever really explained? And in my last book, I go through, you know, how I talk to the faculty and priests who were good friends of mine, because my brother was a priest and he was a theologian, for heaven's sake. And you know, I'd talk about, you know, purgatory, things of this kind, you know, the place where you go. Supposedly, if you are not quite bad enough to go to hell, but not quite good enough to go to heaven, you go to purgatory, and, you know, sooner or later, you get saved. But then Einstein comes along and gums up the whole works with his theory of special relativity, that there is no time, really. You know, it's really a function of our consciousness. So how can you have time? And so all these questions just kept piling up. And when I was in the seminary, I'd ask all sorts of very annoying questions to the faculty, not just stuff like this, but stuff like, I don't know, okay, Easter's coming up, right, George? You got Holy Week, and
that's right.
You got Christ, according to the Bible, was in the tomb for 3 days. Well, you know, evening on Friday to morning, the break of dawn on Sunday is not 3 days. It's like a day and a half, right? And I would ask stuff like that, and they'd say, oh, it doesn't make any difference, you know, and maybe it doesn't make any difference, but I mean, that kind of stuff bothered me. You know, how come, you know, if Jesus was truly God and truly man, as the doctrine says, why wouldn't he have had a wife and reproduced?
You know, unless that's what they say.
I mean, these, and they'd say, well, of course not. Well, that's not an answer. So anyway, that's what has kept me in the paranormal, is my absolutely persistent and insistent questioning of everything, and even the paranormal. You know, when you question the old ideas about it, and we've talked about this many times, you enter undiscovered country, so to speak. You enter new ways of thinking and new ideas that may or may not be true, but at least get you out of the norm and get you into realms that could really, really expand our understanding.
What was it like knowing the late Ed and Lorraine Warren? I mean, great paranormal investigators, great investigators.
Yeah, well, you know, the question I often get, and I have to preface this by saying that I only worked with them from 1972 to 1978. Okay, so that was really kind of still in their early career. So whatever happened after that, I don't know, because we were out of contact.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first encountered them, they're the sweetest people in the world. Lorraine had read something I'd written about the idea that maybe ghosts are souls in purgatory. Maybe that's what they are. And she thought that was a fabulous idea, because they had sort of this pop Roman Catholic theology that a lot of people who follow the Catholic religion do, and that's why they were attracted to some of my ideas. So I went down, this is in 72, and as a matter of fact, the case in Burwell, Rhode Island, on which The Conjuring was based, had already occurred, so I wasn't involved in that at all, but she would tell me about it, and there were different things that they were involved with. And as time went by, they encouraged me in my seminary studies, and they were kind of like, and as one who lost my father so young, Ed was kind of like a father to me, in a way. At least I felt that way. And but as time went by, there were things that kind of bothered me. Now, I loved them deeply, and I don't think people often ask me, were they frauds? I don't believe they were, but I believe that the theories and methods were inadequate. But they were the theories and methods that everybody was using. So it wasn't necessarily their own, their
right.
fault.
Nobody really knew what to do.
No, they didn't. And you know, here we are standing in this Bridgeport house in 1974, and the poltergeist is tearing the place apart. You know, and we're waiting for the Bishop of Bridgeport to get permission to do an exorcism, which never came. So, I mean, what do? You know, you support the people. You try. I would think, and in later cases, I would always try and record everything, at least take notes, because, you know, in those days we didn't have the technology they have today, for what
right.
it's worth. And, you know, you had a notepad, you maybe had a camera, maybe a tape recorder with an old cassette tape in it.
Yeah.
And that was how you did things. But, and of course, in the chaos of that situation, it was difficult, because I didn't have any of that stuff with me. Later on, when I got thrown out of the seminary and became a reporter, I realized you never go anywhere without your camera and at least a notepad. And today, with recording, you know, stuff as well, which you have with your phone. So it was a wild ride. With them. I remember I would always come home from the seminary and go down, because Lorraine was just an amazing cook. You never missed a meal cooked by Lorraine. And we grew very close. But again, there were things I just thought that they should be doing differently. And we finally kind of broke up, because my ideas were beginning to separate from the old traditional ideas that they and just about everybody else followed. And I was getting into the people seeing ghosts of themselves and the ghosts or phantoms or whatever of buildings, and sometimes even entire towns would come up. And I don't know, it was different from what they were dealing with. And I got beyond, I think, the theology even that I was learning. None of it was good enough to me. Now, maybe that's because of my questioning, but we kind of, in 78, we disagreed on a case in Rhode Island where I ended up living. And I just didn't like the way Ed was handling it, because he would hand off cases to me that he didn't have time for or they really wasn't interested in. Because,
okay.
you know, they
yeah.
say...
He kept the good ones for himself, huh?
Yeah, I suppose that's normal. I mean, because they made a living at this, something that also made me kind of uncomfortable, because when people make a living, and I'm not saying they were dishonest, I'm just saying when people make a living at this, they tend to have a vested interest in things being weird.
Right, okay? Right.
And now, again, I never had any doubt about, you know, them being fraud, because they, I don't believe they were. What happened after 78, I have no idea, because I was out of touch. But it was a wild ride. I loved them very deeply. It was something that, and as a matter of fact, they encouraged, when I switched from the Roman Catholic to the Orthodox Church, because I thought it was more, you know, faithful to the original Christianity, they encouraged me. And I thought that was very big of them, because a lot of people who were Roman Catholics thought I wanted to be a married priest, or that I had ulterior motives and all.
Sure.
So they were very supportive. Again, you know, I didn't agree with everything they did, and certainly we drifted apart like that. But we parted in peace. Ed and I met up at our favorite ice cream joint, and you know, we had sort of a conference at the end. And I just kind of moved on from there. So I loved them, but I was out of touch after 1978.
Are you glad, Paul, that you did not become a priest eventually?
Well, there are times when I think that the church and I both had a lucky escape.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It wasn't the Roman Catholics that threw me out. It was, as a matter of fact, at the second seminary, the college-level seminary I attended, Wadhams Hall in Ogdensburg, New York, the faculty was really quite supportive of this work, which surprised me, especially given my youth. I was, you know, 20, 21 years old. And I ended up working with the, I don't know if the faculty even knew about this, with the diocesan exorcist who liked Ed and Lorraine. As a matter of fact, Ed and Lorraine came up to the seminary at their own expense at one point in late 74, early 75, and they lectured. And a lot of the fellows who had, you know, were theological thinkers were a little surprised at some of their points of view, which were common points of view among the Roman Catholic rank and file. But, you know, be that as it may, they sat, Ed was closeted with Father Lawrence, it's his first name, for several hours in his room, because he lived at the seminary. And Ed came out and said, you know, he's amazing. You know, I wish I had him closer, and I'd have him with me in any emergency at all. So the faculty was quite supportive, and I went through a few weird things, quite a few odd things. But by 78, I had been thrown out. I went to the Orthodox Seminary in New York City, outside New York City, St. Vladimir's, and they didn't want to hear it. You're a new convert. Keep your nose in your books, and never mind. They didn't like Ed and Lorraine at all. All right. And so I suppose I just should have kept my mouth.
Yeah, well, they probably thought it was work of the devil or something.
Well, I don't know if they thought that. They just thought I was too inexperienced. I mean, really, they'd known half the stuff I'd been through. And they thought I really needed to concentrate on studying the theology and leave this other stuff till later. You know, they thought I was taking on too much. And again, it made them very uncomfortable.
Had you become a priest, might you have become an exorcist?
Well, if I'd been an Orthodox priest, the wrinkle with that was that Orthodox priests tend to be, our parish priests anyway, are usually married, and that was really not even on my radar. I was in the middle of my first semester, and somebody, do you have a girlfriend? I said, well, no. And so that was an entirely, and of course, I was still 14 years old emotionally, because I'd entered the RC seminary at the age of 14.
Sure.
You know, preparing for a celibate life, so. Needless to say, my first relationship was a total disaster. We're still friends. As a matter of fact, she's one of the producers of our show, because we're in our, you know, 60s now. But it was quite the fun ride. But had I been a priest, it would depend on my bishop, priests of Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic ilk have to follow what their bishops say, or at least they're supposed to. So I don't know. I really can't answer the question with any authority, because I don't know. I would have kept up with it one way or the other.
You did participate in some exorcisms, though, didn't you?
Yes. That was in 73. Well, the first one was in 73. And it was the thing is that Father Lawrence was the Catholic chaplain at the St. Lawrence State Hospital outside of Ogdensburg, right on the St. Lawrence River, which, of course, is the Canadian border at that point. And I think my boss, Bishop John Marshall of the Diocese of Burlington, Vermont, had sent me to that seminary to keep me out of mischief. And I think he got more than he bargained for, because when I teamed up with Father Lawrence, it was anything but, you know, out of the way and quiet. There were a lot of strange things going on at the hospital. I think there's a reason why a lot of the ghost hunting teams will concentrate on former mental hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, because there were a lot of suffering. At the time, the economy in St. Lawrence County was just awful. People were losing their farms. A lot of drug problems going on. You name it, it was bad that was happening. And sometimes when the doctors would be in the room and stuff would start flying off shelves on the other side of the room, obviously it was nothing to do with the person's psychosis or psychoses that had been diagnosed, but something outside of them, and that's when they'd call in Father Lawrence. And after a number of long conversations, he asked if I would help assist him in this. Now, there were several people who would assist. There was a doctor, always a doctor, two nurses, an attendant at the hospital, and myself. And then the patient, or as the ritual of exorcism calls them, the sick person. Okay, strangely enough. And there were a lot of awfully weird things that happened. There was a poltergeist activity at some points. At one point, the girl Barbara. My first and worst experience with this literally floated out of the wheelchair, and the other attendant and I had to, like, push her back down.
Wow.
And eventually the nurses had to bind her to the wheelchair with, some soft things that wouldn't hurt her but keep her from floating away. Really strange. Probably the worst experience that I have ever had in the paranormal. It took several months to dawn on me. It's difficult to talk about, but at one point, and exorcisms can take weeks or even months, but Father Lawrence was like really quick, and I understand he had to go back and do some more. It was complicated, but there are several points at which, in the ritual, three points where the priest commands the demon, quote-unquote, and I came to believe these are more than that, to give its name. And this thing came out with a voice that was... not the girls, and said Chal, which I assumed was spelled C-H-A-L-L, something like that.
Yeah.
And I told Father Lawrence, I said, how do we know these things are really telling the truth? He said, well, they're bound by the authority of Christ to tell the truth about what their name is. So I said, all right, I bought that. So in my mind, when the thing said Chal, I said, yeah, right, just in my mind,
mm-hmm.
That thing
picked
somehow
it up.
Heard me, and it came out with a language in that same voice, and none of us could tell, but the doctor had to look it up. Now, the doctor was recording this. I wasn't allowed to record it, and I wasn't allowed to take notes, but I took notes when I got back to school. But I don't know what it said. Finally, in May, before the end of the school year, Father Lawrence called me and he said, you know, I really cannot let you go home without telling you what that said, because it was directed at you. So I said, well, what was it? And the thing had said in perfect Malay, as I say, the doctor had to look up.
Make sure you can say it on the radio, Paul, right?
Well, I'll say it in English. I mean, it said, I was there. When your father killed himself, I told him to do it.
Oh.
And my God, George, had that been in English, I would have ended up a patient there.
Absolutely. And who would have known?
I know. And he said, and Father Lawrence said, you know, I don't feel right letting you go home without telling you what that thing said. And I don't know if he expected me to quit right then and there. Maybe not the seminary, but any involvement with this. But I think he had hopes for me becoming possibly a diocesan exorcist, because people think clergy are trained in this. They're not. Certain ones are, such as himself, you know, at least in their narrow view of what this is, and they're the go-to people in the Catholic diocese for this. Other clergy, same, really kind of the same thing. But I don't think I uttered a word all the way home, and it was a 9-hour drive from the seminary to my home in Connecticut, and just... That had to be probably the most jarring experience of all the jarring experiences I've had in this field.
These entities know how to hurt. Paul, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back in a moment and talk more about your work on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, paranormal expert Paul Eno. We'll take calls with Paul next hour here on Coast to Coast, so make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, Paul Eno with us. Paul, when you wrote Dancing Past the Graveyard, that came out in August of 2019, you really didn't like writing it. How come?
Well, I had to dig up all kinds of memories that I'd worked very hard to bury, George. I've just told you several of them when talking about exorcisms. I also had to report on, if you want to say, communications with multiversal beings, shall we say, and other people in sort of different places, and neighbors, as we come to call them in a certainly ubiquitous way. It made it sound like I was doing the medium thing, something that I've always advised people not to do, so I sounded like a hypocrite. But, you know, you get to a certain age, and I think you and I are roughly the same vintage, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, and you realize that if you don't tell the story, you're just not gonna, it's not going to get told. So I really hated writing the book, but it's been very well received nevertheless.
Well, it's a great book. You did a good job doing that, to be sure.
Thank you. Coming from you, that means a lot.
The subtitle of Poltergeist, Parasites, and Parallel Worlds in God. Tell me about the parasites part.
Well, that goes right back to the exorcism thing. I was just getting the impression, as we were doing this, in this ritualized, you know, way to express authority over these quote-unquote demons, I got the impression these things were feeding on this. Even though we were very hard to keep emotions under control, you can't help but get excited and this sort of thing. And then I believe that the ritual was helping these entities, which I believe were parasites. They were feeding on the emotions that resulted. I couldn't really explain it. And then a year later, here I am in the Bridgeport House with Ed and Lorraine Warren, and at one point on the Monday night of the case, November 25th, 1974, I'm in the house with the family and a couple of other people, and the Warrens had gone off to do some TV interview. These things attacked.
Oh, jeez.
Now, the poltergeists, in our opinion, these were demons, and that's where I was theologically, too. But I got the impression that there were four of them, and when four of them came down the hall, you could almost see these gauzy structures, and I was protecting the little girl, Marcy, who apparently was the center of this. And this is where I learned the hard way not to become agitated, fearful, annoyed, or angry in the face of these things because they would feed on it. And, of course, I felt sorry for the little girl. I knew it was after her, and this thing came and stood right in front of me. And a demon is what? It's supposed to be an evil spirit, but nevertheless a spirit, totally non-corporeal by definition. Well, this thing, after I put her behind me, there were a couple of others in the room, I literally, just out of instinct, kind of pushed against this thing. It pushed back, and I felt a physical structure, almost like an anatomy. It wasn't human. And when I lecture on this, I have illustrations of almost bird-like creatures, because that's what it felt like. I became so agitated because, you know, the thing with this thing talking in Malay about my father's suicide was bad enough. But when you stand there, you know, really, George, all we have is our belief systems, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And when I'm standing there and this physical being that wasn't supposed to be physical shattered my belief system, it was too much. The thing got around me, threw the little girl across the room, and I said, everybody out of the house. It just felt like the place was going to explode. So to me, that's what parasites are, because we went out, and fortunately the police had blocked off both ends of the street so we didn't walk out in the middle of a crowd. If anybody knows the story of that case, it's quite wild. A lot of press, probably the best witness poltergeist in history, if you will. And I just felt that these things were parasitical entities, part of nature, undiscovered science, if you will. And by the end of the 70s, I was just convinced of this. And that's what parasites are, energy feeders. And they feed upon negative human activity and emotion. Because after all the crosses and holy water and exorcisms, I came to the conclusion finally by the end of the 70s that what you do is you cut off the food supply. And you do that by bringing in positive energy to replace the negative energy. I once got rid of the worst poltergeist I ever dealt with, worse than Bridgeport, by using a joke book.
A joke book? What happened?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't ordinarily recommend that, I mean, as a normal approach. But when I came into this case, it was in North Haven, Connecticut, And a woman had been, this is in the book, a woman had been with her daughter there. Something had attacked. They had brought in all the worst things you can do, seances, a medium, which, of course, is all, you know, in my opinion, sledgehammer techniques to try and break through the boundaries of worlds, and who knows what's going to come in. And six of them did, parasites. When I walked in there, this is 1979. I walked in and usually it takes time for these things to get used to you. A huge chair the size of a Volkswagen came hurtling for my head, and if I hadn't ducked, this conversation might not be taking place.
Right.
This is the closest I ever saw to a Hollywood, you know, kind of poltergeist situation. But what happened was these things had so much energy and had expended so much. And she had stopped feeding them because I told her to stop going in there and fighting, arguing with it and doing all this stuff, that they were pretty much kind of at the end of their cycle anyway. And I went in with a former classmate at the seminary, and we sat down, and the daughter came back. We had a nice dinner, and we yucked it up the whole evening. And we had a great time, a lot of fellowship, thing never seen or heard from again. So, again, not the usual approach, but in this particular case, it seems to work. Ben and I call it the Peter Pan theory, you know, think happy thoughts. And Ed Warren always told me, you know, you have to keep your sense of humor. And we kind of maybe took
it. It's not easy, but you have to do that.
Right, it's true.
Now, you've had contacts with, here's the subtitle in the book, Parallel Worlds. You've had contacts with some entities like that, haven't you?
Yes, and again, I hadn't wanted to write about this because it's not like I'm doing the medium thing, but I just didn't feel that I could just go any further without telling these stories. Well, going back again to the mid-70s, to the St. Lawrence State Hospital, there was a hallway there in one of the wards that was considered really weird. Like, the staff didn't like to be there at night. The patients would be sometimes difficult to deal with. You get all excited. And I happened to feel that way myself. Something was weird in this hallway. And so I kind of started to think of it as the haunted ward. So there was a woman in there who claimed to be a psychic medium. Now, the seminarians would come and would visit the patients, not all of whom were psych patients because it was a state hospital. Some were, you know, indigent and couldn't afford a regular hospital, all this sort of thing. So I was talking with a young Catholic lady who claimed to be a psychic medium, and I said, you know, you really shouldn't do that as a Catholic. She said, oh, it's fine. You know, you couldn't argue with her. So she told me that the reason the hallway was weird was because there was a guy who was waiting for his wife, and he was going to take her home. Now, the implication in any kind of common belief about these things is that she was a patient there. She didn't know who she was. She was about to die, and the husband, who had already passed away, was going to take her home, all right? You know, the through the tunnel, the lights are all shining, the angels are singing or whatever. But, you know, being the questioner that I was, I said, no, that's not good enough. Something else is going on here. So there was a little room along this hallway that was supposed to be a chapel. Really, it was just a room with a skylight. They had the table with a cross on it and really nothing else. And so I went in there, and the nursing staff knew all the seminarians who would come and visit. And they probably figured that I was just being reverent or something for disappearing into this chapel, because it took three nights. And so then I was sweet-talked them, and, you know, that I was just, you know, meditating or whatever. So, make a long story short, I happened to encounter, just in a meditative state, I didn't try to contact anybody, meditative state, very quiet, I met a guy named Gilbert. And I heard right in my ear the word hello. Not hello, hello. And a conversation ensued that took, as I say, several days. It would fade in and out. And it was with a guy who was waiting for his wife, and he was going to take her home. But he was waiting for his wife across the St. Lawrence River at the Canadian National Railway Station in Prescott, Ontario.
Oh, my.
For her to come in from Montreal, and he was going to take her home. That's what it was all about. The guy spoke English. It was kind of odd. The syllables were in the wrong places, and there were some strange terms I had to learn. And, you know, before long, I figured, I'm talking to a guy in a parallel world that's very similar to ours, But the strange thing, in the course of the conversation, he said that was very, this is where I got the term neighbors that we put in our glossary of terms we had to invent just to talk about this stuff. And the neighbor, he said it was not unusual in his world for people to talk to the neighbors, people from parallel worlds. And the laws of physics were such that they could do that on a limited basis. And that's why he started to talk to me. He sensed my presence. And I didn't know what to do with this. I had never heard of anything like this before. I'd never seen anything like it in paranormal literature before, or really even since, really. And I said, am I bonkers here? Of course, the last thing I needed was for the nursing staff to hear me talking to myself in this room, you know, in the middle of a psych hospital. So that was another issue. But I went back to the seminary, and I kind of stayed in my room. And I didn't eat. And finally, you know, some of my friends came and said, what's the matter with you? What am I going to tell them? Like, I counted the guy from Parallel World. So this Gilbert person. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, George, I actually heard it sounded like a diesel locomotive, you know, coming from a distance. And I said, what the hey is this is going on here? And that's where I started to, and I never did that a lot, but there were a number of contacts that really did occur, at least for me, in the course of this kind of meditation. So, I mean, the guy didn't need rescuing. I mean, the wife wasn't about to die. Nobody was dead. Matter of fact, it wasn't long before I came to not even believe in death. I don't think the thing even exists. How could it in a world where there are all these versions of yourself, including your body? How can death have any meaning in such a place? So other contacts included a few years later in Buffalo, New York area, Tonawanda, actually, up not too far from Niagara Falls. A friend of mine said that they were hearing strange things in the attic of some people he knew. So off I went, and it seems to be a lot of attics for me. And it took a while, but I went into the same kind of state, and I encountered, and when you do this, you often will encounter, you know, there's a language barrier. I'm often struck by how many of these things seem to speak English in the terms of mediumistic activity, but I don't encounter that. Sometimes they're nonverbal. Sometimes they just don't. Sometimes they're afraid of you because they think you're a ghost haunting them. If they have similar belief systems, I run into that a lot. But this particular attic in New York State had a bear-like, and I say that was seemed to be the energy. It was very earth sign, you know, coming off this creature, but of an incredible nobility. I've never encountered anything quite like it, and I never got a name, but he spoke a form of Latin, and I actually got a photograph. The only time I ever did during one of these things, because that's not what I was concentrating on. I was concentrating on the communication, not on the research as such. And he seems to be holding something in his hand that was bright. And it was a warrior type of creature. And he spoke a very, very strange form of Latin, which had very odd case endings. And from what I got from the conversation, if I was interpreting it correctly, and this is where God kind of comes in again, there was a female deity or a goddess, or you know, certainly something with a female identity, that had sent him on a quest to a place called Renthusia, which I had never encountered before or since. Now, what that is, I don't know, but it's pretty clear. So I can go on and on with how weird this gets. But eventually, he said he was encountering travelers on this quest, travelers presumably being people in parallel worlds who would communicate with him, including myself. And again, I didn't know what to do with this. And of course, things like this would happen throughout the last, you know, 30 or 40 years on a very sporadic basis, and convinced me that we're dealing with parallel realities here of a kind that we just can't really grasp because of our narrow paradigm. And that's why I always say it, like it's the first day of school here. And if you reinterpret many of the mediumistic stories that we've heard throughout paranormal literature and throughout paranormal history, you could interpret them in terms of these parallel worlds. And because of our narrow paradigm, we think that we're dealing with dead people.
Exactly.
Maybe there are no dead people.
Well, you know, a lot of us believe disembodied spirits are ghosts. You have your own views on what ghosts are at this point, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I say, we're very frequently running into ghosts who think that we're ghosts haunting them because they're going about their daily business and their worlds, most of which are perfectly physical. And why do they think we're ghosts? Well, what are you looking through? You're looking through, theoretically, if we're right, the plasma-charged membranes, and physicists actually call them membranes or brains, B-R-A-N-E-S, and what are you going to see? You've got plasma between you and you're going to see a glowing figure. Are you going to see a shadow? Are you going to see something that's really creepy and spooky, right? Hence the folklore, okay? And what we're really doing is looking at the actual people, I think in most cases, and they're seeing us too. So I think it's really our misinterpretation, and it's, you know, our intellectual battle to lose or to win, based on, you know, thinking of these things in new ways and new ideas. As I say, I think today's paranormal is tomorrow's science.
Exactly. Paul Eno with us. We're going to take calls with Paul next hour here. Questions and stories about the paranormal. Paul, my website I have for you is behindtheparanormal.com. Is that still accurate?
Absolutely, yep.
And the books, Dancing Past the Graveyard, The Bell Witch Project, and you've got so many others as well. What are you working on next?
We're working on Behind the Paranormal 3, Uneasy Skies. We're always invited to speak at UFO conventions, so we should at least do the courtesy of writing a book about UFOs, which includes some of our own pretty amazing experiences.
Well, you had a Pennsylvania experience, didn't you?
Oh, yes, sir, we did. As a matter of fact, I sent you the video. I sent your producers the video, and everything bounced back, which was really strange. But if I was in May of 19, and really, really quite amazing. Six of us saw it. Really amazing in a flap area. That's another term we had to invent, where Bigfoot is very common. I myself had an encounter there. Ghosts, strange lights, the military, you name it, it's going on there. So we got this video, and it's on
hotbed.
Facebook if people want to see it.
It is definitely a hotbed. And you believe in extraterrestrial life, don't you?
Well, yeah, how could there not be? But the question is, what does that even mean? I mean, you've got all these, I've dealt with alien beings in this Bridgeport house. I felt that these were alien. They were totally other, you know, and we thought they were demons. And people say, oh, you were in the seminary, you must think all aliens are demons. Well, no, maybe demons are aliens, you know. Everything's upside down, you know, just a new way of looking at it. But, yeah, I have a lot of strange, strange questions and strange beliefs.
Okay, well, stand by. We're going to come by and take your calls with Paul Eno in just a moment, share your stories, talk about the paranormal next on Coast to Coast AM.